Welcome to Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent former federal officials and special guests for a dynamic discussion of the most important political and legal topics of the day. I'm Harry Littman. Before we jump into this week's episode, I just want to take a second to plug a really exciting event we have coming to kick off a first-of-its-kind series in the San Diego area. We are launching a lecture series, Talking San Diego, that will feature live conversations with some of the most prominent figures in the country. We plan in coming years to bring to Southern California a great set of the most interesting political figures, authors of important new books, public intellectuals, and out-of-the-box thinkers and performers. And I feel so honored to have as our first guest for Talking San Diego, a friend of the pod, constitutional law professor, a prominent congressman, and most notably, a tireless warrior for constitutionalism and the rule of law, Representative Jamie Raskin. Congressman Raskin will be joining me in conversation at UCSD's new downtown building at Park and Market on Monday, March 18th at 2 o'clock. If you or someone you know in the region would be interested in purchasing a ticket, which are going fast, or want to learn more about the upcoming events for Talking San Diego, please visit talkingsandiego.net or click the link in the description of this episode. That's talkingsandiego.net. All right, on with this week's episode. It was a tough week for the cause of accountability. Not because any court held for Trump on any question of significance, but because events conspired to depress the odds that Trump will face justice in the form of a jury trial for his wicked conduct as president and after. Most importantly, the Supreme Court, after 13 days of deliberation, opted to hear Trump's immunity appeal. The court set a fast but hardly blazing timeline that means it will retain the case and the stay in Judge Chutkan's court will remain in place until at least the end of May. That in turn translates to a trial around Labor Day at the earliest, and any of several contingencies could knock it back further to after the election, as Donald Trump dearly hopes. Other complications in Fulton County and Mar-a-Lago pushed those cases back, leaving the New York DA case scheduled to begin in 3 weeks as the likely main and sole event. That trial is the subject of sharp differences in perception as to whether it's a tacky sex case or a serious fraud scheme to keep damaging information from voters. And Mitch McConnell, who danced with the devil during his tenure as Republican leader in the Senate, announced he was stepping down from that position, though retaining his seat. For many people, his legacy will be sheer Machiavellian power-mongering and indifference to the erosion of Senate traditions of bipartisanship and collegiality. To assess the dwindling prospects of a trial in Washington, D.C., Fulton County, or Mar-a-Lago, and to provide a first draft of the legacy of one Mitch McConnell as Republican leader in the Senate, we have a fantastic crew of three Talking Fed stalwarts, really great friends all to the podcast. And they are Norm Eisen, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institute, a legal analyst for CNN, and the author of 5 books and counting. Hello, Uncle Norm.
Hello, Uncle Harry. You can tell everybody about the 6th book. It will be coming out in the weeks ahead.
This is the one on the Alvin Bragg trial, right?
Yeah.
And that's going to be important. And we're going to have a special episode that's going to be a real nuts and bolts trial lawyers episode about how that's going to play out and featuring the Norm Eisen trial notebook. But that's for later. Uncle Norm Ornstein, an emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a contributing editor for The Atlantic, a very prolific author, and co-host of the podcast Words Matter with Kavita Patel.
Thank you, Harry. And I do have to say that I've already bid in for an autographed copy of Norm's new book, and it was only $130,000.
Very good. And Aunt Jen Rubin, an opinion columnist for the Washington Post, a best-selling author, and a law school classmate. Thanks, as always, for joining, Jen.
It's always fun.
Wait a minute.
You didn't know this?
Jen Rubin was your law school classmate?
Yes. No.
What else? And what other little detail should we add? Just like Norm is one of the top 100 thinkers of all time, and Jen Rubin is first in the damn class, so you know I wasn't. There you have it. So, but let's jump in. Man, a lot's happening in the different areas. We'll start with the immunity case and the Supreme Court's order issued yesterday. So after 13 days of deliberations, the court opted to treat Trump's emergency motion as a petition for cert, proceeded to grant it, and set oral argument for the week of April 22nd. All right, so let's just start with the all-important question on everyone's mind of timing. Add what, a month minimum for the court to write the opinions, probably more than one. That would be pretty quick. So we're talking about a best case scenario that the mandate returns to Chutkan late May, say early June. I think that's where most people are. Where does that leave the prospect for a trial in 2024? Uncle Norm Eisen wrote, there's still a chance. The insurrection case is determined before if they act with haste. Explain your view why the prospects are still alive, and then we'll get everyone else's thoughts.
The Just Security website posted an assessment, a timeline of all the different possibilities. And the conventional wisdom is too severe, in my view, on the prospect that a trial has become impossible. Instead, if the Supreme Court resolves the question presented in a way that rejects absolute immunity, which they must do, but doesn't leave fact-finding for the court, if they say, we'll talk about the question presented, there's a key reference in there, the key word, allegedly, which allegations are they talking about? Jen and I are on one side. Jack Goldsmith is on the other side, which surely means Jen and I are right. If allegedly means if it's a reference to the allegations in the indictment, and the Supreme Court is going to make a ruling based on what is in the indictment, then we certainly can get a trial started at some point, August, September. If there's a remand for an evidentiary hearing, forget about it. And those are the two gating questions for your question.
And we'll go back to the question presented. And I actually think the different camps here have a same kind of timing in mind. So remote or dead in the water or real possibility, what are we going to see a trial in 2024, Norm and Jen?
I'm still a little more pessimistic, although I've listened carefully to what Norm and Jen and others have said. And the reason that I'm pessimistic is I don't trust John Roberts to keep a firm hand on this. And what I fear is that Clarence Thomas, who I am sure, being consistently corrupt, will not recuse himself from this case. And I fear that he and Alito will work to drag this out as long as they possibly can, and that Roberts won't intervene. So that's my problem with this. If this were done in a pristine basis, going by the facts, going by the language that we've been talking about, yeah, there'd be a chance. But I think it's gotten slimmer when you think about the Roberts Court.
Well, if you consider all of the off-ramps the court didn't take, I think it tells you why we're where we are. First of all, the court could have denied cert and denied the stay. There was a perfectly sound, absolutely laudable agreement by the D.C. Circuit that you can't have absolute immunity. Of course you can't. And the famous Seal 6 example that Trump seemed to accept. Yeah, that's what he's talking about. He wants immunity from that. So they could have denied cert. Secondly, they could have granted cert and done a summary affirmance. Third, they could have moved with the same alacrity that the Watergate court did. And thanks to Norm Eisen and Just Security, I looked it up and they only took about a week. Here they took 2 weeks. Next, they have a trial date or a hearing date rather on April 22nd. if you're playing by the Watergate rules, within a couple weeks, you could have an opinion. But this term ends usually around the end of June, sometimes the beginning of July. That's where they could end up there too. And as we said, they might say, listen, on the allegations of the complaint, which are, remember, him trying to prevent the transfer of power from his own presidency, of course, there's not immunity. Go for it. Or we could have a muddled, mixed opinion and one or more of the justices setting up kind of fact-based question. And just to flesh out what Norm Eisen said, the issue about the alleged conduct, what does that mean? It says the alleged conduct of official acts. Certainly, the complaint doesn't allege their official acts. They're just allegations of conduct by Jack Smith. It is Trump who says everything's an official act. So they're taking that as the standard and accepting at face value that that is the alleged facts. That's sort of like the standard for a motion to dismiss. You accept the allegations as given, but this is the allegations of the defense. It's not even the allegations of the prosecutor. So the language is so squirrely, it leads to this suspicion. And believe me, being the nerd I am, I spent most of the night trying to figure out what they were trying to say. What does this mean? And does it make a difference? And the ultimate answer is we don't know. We're going to find out. And we're going to tell a lot from the oral argument. But I will say this. I do not think, even on this Supreme Court, there are 5 votes to issue a order that says anything like what Trump is looking for, which is a free pass of actions not central to the presidency, are not denominated powers in Article 2, and concern his own reelection. I cannot believe that there are 5 justices for that.
Go ahead, Norm.
I just want to make one more point.
Should
that
we
I
do
think...
Normie and Norm? Well, okay.
Yeah, okay.
We're known as Norm the Elder and Norm the Younger, or our rock band, the Ethical Norms.
I am definitely the elder. I could imagine a ruling, even one that denies absolute immunity, but that's dragged out long enough that it doesn't affect the election. Trump wins, and in effect, he's given absolute immunity for those acts.
The oddity and somewhat convoluted nature of the question presented, the Supreme Court does that. They very carefully wordsmith the questions presented that they want. It's not that one of the parties presented it. The second point, to Jen's point, fast, but not U.S. v. Nixon or Bush v. Gore. Fast, pretty fast. But 3 weeks now for Trump to file his brief, we've seen way faster. But let's zero in on the question presented. Actually, Norm, you had a great piece, Norm the Younger, about zeroing in on 3 different parts of the question. Jen, you had a whole article on it. I want to proffer one of Norm's 3, which is, to what extent? The court says whether and to what extent. To what extent frightens me a lot because I think it suggests something like what Jack Goldsmith is talking about. In other words, some members of the court and eventually moving over 13 days to 5 members saying, we don't want to say never, ever, ever the way the D.C. Circuit did. Goldsmith has put it in terms of core functions or whatever. If they say anything like that, I totally agree with Jen. There's no scenario that he prevails on the merits. But that's a scenario that requires, I think, a remand. Not necessarily, Norm the Younger, for an evidentiary hearing. I think she could just decide more or less on, as a matter of law, there's no argument that what he did was fit within the standard. But then I think maybe we have another quick round up and down the courts, and we are at a place with no margin for error. Any thoughts anyone has about the specific and odd language of the question presented?
So I'll come in first on the to what extent. You can read it 2 ways. You can read it as saying if there's officialness to any extent commingled in the allegations, again, I think it's the allegations in the complaint to read it. You'd have to rewrite the question presented to get to the other view. Maybe it's just clumsy drafting by the court.
Well, or drafting by committee. Five people had to go for that question.
Yeah, well, that's part of the negotiation about time and content, clearly, is what took over 2 weeks. So you can read it as saying a hint of, is any extent enough or not? We just went through this in the Mark Meadows litigation up to and including the 11th Circuit. And an en banc 11th Circuit said no. To what extent? To a slight extent? To a partial extent? No, there needs to be a causal connection. You need to have a predominant officialness. Trump fails on that standard. He certainly fails on the allegations. I'm told I yell when I'm thinking. You know, when I have to think, it just, my brain goes into gear.
I don't perceive that at all. You have a, you're very sotto voce, I'd say. But I do hear where you're going. But what is the holding there that doesn't require a remand?
It's a holding on. We are going to make a determination. This is a determination that is made on the face of the indictment. And looking at this indictment, the extent to which there is official acts does not predominate. So, case over. We are ruling that based on the indictment, there's no immunity. Harry, there's no role for a president in vote counting in Georgia. It's constitutionally pretermitted.
There's another way that to what extent can be read. Actually, there's two others that I can think of. One is that we get into a qualified immunity balancing test in which we're weighing the severity of, I guess, the charges in this case, even though U.S. v. Nixon held it in criminal cases, the balance does tip that way, but I guess you'd have to repeat that here. So you're saying there's a qualified immunity, but not an absolute immunity. That's the to what extent. And the other is that we're talking about outer perimeters again. And that is that, well, the laws, he's supposed to make sure the Justice Department accurately, you know, enforces the law, blah, blah, blah. So that's good enough. So there are a bunch of ways in which you get that. And either the Supreme Court was trying not to say anything about anything, or this is just evidence that the hands of those who want to muck this up and make it more complicated than it needs to be are prevailing, because they came up with this cockamamie question that no one can really even figure out what they want.
Okay, and this is getting rather Talmudic, but I want to go to the bottom line here. I think, Norm the Younger, even as you've put it, it's a remand. Are they really going to hold? Maybe. They're going to say, we have this record, we have the allegations, and not just state what the standard is for immunity, but actually determine on that standard, which should be an easy determination, I grant you, Trump loses, is not the, in their normal job description. So even if they put it the way you put it and something about predominate, etc., I don't see that section four that then says, applying it to the petitioner, we find. I mean, it's just the normal thing then to remand. And of course, as Jen says, we're shooting in the dark.
And that's why I'm not 100%.
Right. Okay.
The wonderful Ryan Goodman, my editor on this Just Security piece.
And he is wonderful. Yeah.
He is wonderful. I wrote likely, and he's like, well, your reasoning is, it's more than merely likely. I'm like, no, I'm not going there. Likely is as far as, because there's so many uncertainties. And all of this tea leaf question presented reading has to be taken with a grain of salt. We're figuring it out together in real time, okay? So part of that is putting your ideas, you have a reaction, you have a gut instinct. Of course, Jack is a Lawfare colleague who I often debate with, but he also makes a very powerful contribution to the public discourse. And, you know, we're just examining all parts of the question, and we'll see if we're right. And if I'm not right, I'm always quick to say so, once every 10 years or so.
We just hope to illuminate it for others. But let me say, I think everyone is basically of the same view about timing. Everyone is basically of the same view about next to no margin of error. And that, I think, however we parse the language, that's an important consensus to keep in mind. Let's say we're all correct and nothing more happens, and a trial would otherwise start in September. I know Chutkan has said, I'm not going to think about the election, etc. If Chutkan says we're going ahead, Trump will clearly say, we are in the home stretch here. What are you talking about? Try to do a mandamus. Is there another thing we have to put into the hopper of some higher court will freeze things saying we're just too much in the thick of the election?
I think it will start, but that process of seeking a mandamus and all the other horsing around will be another couple of weeks. So we can't ignore that. I just want to make one additional point. We've been focusing on the Supreme Court and slow walking it. I want to underscore again and again, we would not be in this fix if Merrick Garland had gotten on his horse and said, you know what? I don't need to work my way from the bottom up. We have the crime. It's been on national television. We know what this guy was doing. I'm going to send my investigators in to the White House, start sending out subpoenas, question these guys, and indict when I have evidence that the President of the United States committed a crime. I don't need to tie him to the Proud Boys if I ever find that. I'm going for the guy. And had he done that, we would have been done by now. And I got to say, the comparison between him and Tish James, who is an aggressive prosecutor who does not listen to the harumphing from the right wing, is like night and day.
And I'll just note my standing dissent here. Norm, you wanted to pile on your fellow Midwesterner, Merrick Garland?
And an old friend as well. The great and tragic irony here, and let's hope it doesn't come to it, is that in bending over not just backwards, but doubly, triply, quadruply backwards, and that includes not prosecuting any of the members of Congress who were neck deep in insurrection, so far as we know, nothing against Clarence Thomas, who lied over and over on his disclosure forms, which is a crime that has been prosecuted in other places, to show that this was a different Justice Department than the Bill Barr Justice Department, may lead us to a Justice Department that makes Bill Barr's look pristine by comparison. And that would be a legacy that no one should wish to happen.
Standing objection renewed. Last question is, what impact does this whole thing have on the one trial that is going forward, Alvin Bragg?
It pushes it front and center. It's going to be perhaps most likely, more than likely than not, the only trial that begins and certainly the only trial that ends before the election. And I think people have poo-pooed it, have cast aspersions on Alvin Bragg for even bringing the case. I think it's an important case. It does go to deceiving the electorate. This was the electorate in 2016. He committed, if the allegations hold up, crimes, including the business falsification. And he did so in furtherance of other crimes, tax crimes, both state and federal election finance crimes. This is serious stuff. It has been prosecuted. It comes with potential jail time. And we are going to see how Donald Trump treats voters, treats the electorate, and treats the law, which is with complete contempt. And we will see someone without remorse. And it'll be very interesting to see if he gets on the stand and defends his behavior.
The 2016 case, Harry, was the gateway drug to the 2020 misconduct, at least as you know, I feel. And I've been saying this for a very long time. And I think people are starting to wake up to this. And I think it's going to be part of the drama of the unfolding, the pretrial that we're now in, the trial itself, and the verdict. I believe the criminal sentencing and likely jail sentence that will unfold. I think it's going to be this drama of, is it a salacious, minor, hush money matter, or is it actually a very profound question of corrupting an election, extremely close election, another sex scandal on top of Access Hollywood in the last days, that might have changed the outcome of an election decided by 80,000 votes, we'll never know, in three states. And then a cover-up of that election corruption. Thousands of people are prosecuted, don't believe when they say, oh, document falsification. No, that is not a rare or special crime. That is the bread and butter. It's like, Harry, when you were a federal prosecutor, it's like mail and wire fraud. That's the bread and butter. 10,000 cases almost across New York since 2015. And hundreds of people are prosecuted, investigated, fined for making illicit contributions to campaigns, doing things with the intent to benefit a campaign, okay? That's what Donald Trump was doing in these payments, because the evidence is when the campaign ended, he asked Michael Cohen, do I still have to pay? So I think what people are going to realize is this is a very important election-related case. It's corruption of an election. It's election misconduct. In a way, it's the election tampering of 2020 precursor. And it's 34 felonies. Each felony carries a year and a third to 4 years. I don't think the judge will stack them, but I do think that he will face a significant risk of jail time. And that is the last chapter in my forthcoming book. The working title, we're just going to press as we speak. I have to finalize the title. My working title has been, it's not just a hush money case, because I'm constantly saying that to people. It will be a complete trial notebook, like the trial notebooks that I prepare when I try a case. I have a big notebook that I carry with me everywhere that has the most essential documents. That will be a trial notebook for all of you. And I think that that is going to be the drama of this trial.
I just want to say trenchant analysis at the same time as he's publishing his newest book, just another Friday for Norm the Younger.
This, by the way, is the danger of Trump getting on the stand to testify, because if he gets on the stand and lies, this goes to sentencing.
What if? If he goes on the stand, he lies.
Exactly. So if he does that, he is walking himself right into jail. So if you are a sane defendant with a sane counsel, you do not get on the stand. Trump is not sane. He has an excellent lawyer in this case. We shouldn't be fooled, by the way, that the same bozos who've been representing him in the civil cases are going to show up here. He is going to be imploring his client not to get on the stand, but ultimately the client decides.
And by the way, a tough judge who will do just that, though I can't quite see putting him in pending appeal.
No, he's not going to be put in. He's going to be sentenced. No way he's put in.
Exactly. Put in pending appeal. I agree with that.
Right.
Sorry, Norm the Elder, for my rudeness. Sorry, barging in.
So I had started referring to this as the election-related fraud case, but I think Norm's given us a better title. This is the election tampering case. We need to get it away from... If it's about hush money, you're going to have a lot of people who think, well, yeah, you know, he did something really bad. He slept with a porn star, but it was embarrassing. It's not about embarrassment. It's about tampering with an election. The second point is when Bragg brought this case, very, very widely, there was criticism of him. This is a stupid case. This is a weak case. Why is he horning in when we have these powerful cases on January 6th in Washington, in Georgia, on the Mar-a-Lago? And Norm Eisen was among those who said, wrong. This is really serious stuff. And what we're finding out now is, thank God for Alvin Bragg, because this is the one sure thing we have, and the others are far from being a sure thing.
So I agree with everything you guys have said. And I think the way Norm puts it is, it really is going to be this sort of struggle. You can already see Bragg out there trying to explain why it's a righteous case. And I agree with him and you. And I just think it's really useful, if you can, to bring it back to exactly where we were. It seems like eons ago, but Access Hollywood was like the first of, what has it been, 15 times where we said, oh, now he's done. But this is a guy who, you know, all through the campaign was the underdog, decidedly, and he had done this thing, and he was hanging at best by a thread, And obviously, when this came out, the real risk is that it would be the coup de grace and the end of his electoral prospects, like he cared so much about Melania back home with their newborn. And that's to recreate and have people remember that time and understand the panic in the Trump world. It wasn't about, you know, another affair being revealed or about it. It was specifically that they were hanging by a thread and this could have cut the thread. Okay, let's just talk a little bit about whether the whole brouhaha and mess in Fulton County, where it leaves that, and whether Eileen Cannon, you know, who also had a hearing today where it sure looked like the July or August move was just a prelude to more moves, whether any of those actually is in the running for a 2024 trial.
I will go on Fulton County. We have spent the last few weeks now down one rabbit hole after another as the judge allows the defense to ruffle through, if you excuse the expression, the bedroom sheets of Fannie Willis and someone with whom she had a personal relationship to no end. The law in Georgia is crystal clear. A sexual relationship, we're not even talking about a sexual relationship between the prosecutor and someone on the defense side, we're talking about within the prosecutor's office, does not constitute a conflict. That this is irrelevant. The only issue that might constitute a conflict would be a financial one. And we could have established that weeks ago that there was none. That issue is not factually in dispute. So what have we been doing? We have been going down this road with witnesses talking about when the affair started.
Cell phone records. Yeah.
All of this, you know, huzzery, which is irrelevant and is really harmful. And I have to say, I do not think if this was a white male prosecutor, we would be here. I think this is the kind of smear that Trump has always run against women of color. It's entirely irrelevant. McAfee, who I thought was pretty much, you know, a square judge, down the middle kind of guy on earlier rulings, let this whole thing get out of hand. And so we've been kind of spinning our wheels. Now, I'll say two things. One, I think it's backfired because women and women of color do not like this one bit. And those are the people who vote. And those are the people who go on juries. Second point, even if we get through all this, and Norm, the younger, is not going to like this. This has been one of our friendly debates. She made this a RICO case, which is sprawling, which is huge, which has nearly 20 defendants. She did not go the Jack Smith route of finding a narrow 4 or 5 count complaint, indictment against Trump and maybe a few in his inner circle. And as a result, jury selection will take months. A trial may take years. So as much as I would like to rely on this case, because I think it, number one, is foolproof from any kind of federal pardon. And number two, it really does get to the heart of his constitutional offense. We're not going to get there.
So I was going to say age before beauty, but I'll just barge ahead. Norm the Elder, this is a talking feds pod like no other. Yeah. The other weird thing that has happened is, as my colleagues know, my computer Zoom failed on my computer for some reason. So I've been trying to do this on my telephone, which falls over every 15 minutes or so with a vertigo-like effect. It's like Hitchcock's vertigo.
This is getting to be a very strong subplot of a day in the life of Norm Eisen. We'll see how much it actually follows through. In fact, here we go. Watch some moderator's prerogative right now. Norm Ornstein, what's your response to Jen Rubin? And we'll let Norm cogitate on his a bit.
Okay, a couple of points. The first is, I have always thought that electing judges was a terrible, terrible part of our system. And it has many, many pernicious side effects. And I think that's what's happened with Judge McAfee here, that he's up for re-election and he decided, instead of doing what he should have done, which is exactly what Jen said, looked at what the law is and it's crystal clear, made it very clear early on that this was all about whether there was any kind of a money exchange that would have been corrupt, made it very clear there wasn't and moved on. He's let this play out because he wants to let every part of this electorate know how fair and open he is. And I think that has been a terrible mistake. The second thing is that because of this particular shit show, that what I think Fannie Willis was trying to do and had started to do was to have this large group and narrow it down to a handful by getting all the others to plead, knowing that they might face significant jail time. And these are not people who could afford to do that. And she began to get several of them to go. And we were working towards a domino effect. This pushed it all aside. And I fear that combined with the other things that are happening, a lot of these defendants are going to gamble now that Trump could win and pardon them all. And that makes it more likely that what Jen said, that it's a trial that could go on with jury selection and the rest of it far longer than I think Fannie Willis had in mind.
I have a different perspective. I feel that the judge is one of the outstanding young jurists that I've seen. He's got less than a year on the bench. He's just done. He's a former prosecutor. He learned his lessons well as a prosecutor, and he's just been outstanding. I think that if he had deep six this, that the questions would have swirled and we never could have gotten past it. Now, maybe it could have moved a little more quickly, but there is a theory of the case that the defendants, I mean, she's not quite Alina Haba level, but Ashley Merchant, who is the lead counsel for this, she clearly did not spend too much time acquainting herself with the rules of evidence before embarking on her trial career. So that was clumsy and bumbling. But there is a theory of the case here. And the judge has taken it seriously. And he's not, I don't think he's playing politics. He's genuinely asking, look, if a prosecutor sets up a secret bonus system for herself and is perpetuating the case in order to get luxury vacations, is that a conflict of interest? That's a real question. The answer, now we have all the evidence, is no. And I think Nathan Wade needs to signal, we can't just get past this. It's not just like calculus, the law and the evidence. Yes, that's clear. We need to, you know, clear the air. And so I think Nathan Wade needs to signal that he's ready to move on. He has been the victim of racism. People didn't think he was qualified. The guy has tried 75 major felony cases, including capital cases. He's won. He's beats his team that he leads has beat some of the best lawyers in the country. In this case, George Terwilliger, Don McGahn, they're two of the greats in D.C. They're not my flavor politically, but I respect them both. I actually get along on a personal level with Don quite well. You know, he's been opposite me my entire career on these campaign finance issues. And then both of us sort of our careers blossomed beyond just political law. So I think there's a real thing there. I think that it was a stupid, foolish, dumb, terrible mistake to have this relationship. That must be said. The case could still be revived for 2024. I disagree with Auntie Jen on that. But, you know, it's a lot of uncertainty. It's like I used to do financial litigation, and I was involved in prosecuting some of those civil cases on behalf of the state AGs against the subprime financial crooks. And you know what they did was they would take three shaky mortgages and package them up and say that they were an A mortgage because of the way the odds of failure amortized across the mortgage pool. Well, the same with these. There's three cases beyond Alvin, all of which have uncertain timetables. But I think if you stack the odds, you get one other case out of those three. So I think it's more likely than not we'll have two cases. It remains more likely than not. Two cases. I'll bet you a kosher hamburger.
With kosher Parmesan, I think you learned from your days as ambassador.
That's right.
It's now time to take a moment for our sidebar feature, which explains some of the issues that are prominent in the news. Today's sidebar is about the National Foundation on the Art and the Humanities Act of 1965, the act that established a national body to promote progress and scholarship in the humanities and the arts. To explain this topic, we welcome Julian Schlossberg. Julian is a veteran motion picture, theater, and television producer. His production credits range from the British mystery Widow's Peak, starring Natasha Richardson and Mia Farrow, to the Broadway musical Bullets Over Broadway. He's been nominated for 2 Oscars, 2 Primetime Emmys, and his plays have won Tonys, Obies, Drama Desks, and Outer Critics Circle Awards. So I give you Julian Schlossberg on the National Foundation on the Art and Humanities Act of 1965.
In September 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed the National Foundation on the Arts and Humanities Act into law. The act was the culmination of several years of organizing by elite education groups, such as the American Council of Learned Societies. The act established the National Endowment for the Arts and the Humanities Foundation. The foundation, in turn, comprised 2 independent sub-agencies, one, the National Endowment for the Arts, NEA, focused on the arts, the other, the National Endowment for Humanities, NEH, focused on the humanities. Since their founding, the agencies have followed a directive to, quote, develop and promote a broadly conceived national policy of support for the humanities and the arts in the United States, and for institutions which preserve the cultural heritage of the United States. In 1996, the Institute of Museum and Library Sciences was established as another sub-agency of the foundation. Over its existence, the NEA has given away nearly $5 billion in grants. The current operating budgets of the NEA and NEH are $162 million and $207 million, respectively. Among the institution's signature achievements are the NEA Jazz Masters Fellowships, the Library of America Special Collections Series, the funding of Ken Burns' masterwork documentary, The Civil War, in 1990, the Jefferson Lecture, and the National Medal of Arts. Not all lawmakers embrace the NEA and NEH. Critics sometimes oppose the content of funded programs, especially works of art they consider decadent or offensive to religious sensibilities, such as the photographs of Robert Mapplethorpe. Others take aim at what they perceive as a public subsidy for elite patrons of the arts who least need them. Over the course of their existence, the NEA and NEH have dodged multiple proposals to scrap them or sharply reduce their budget. These attempts include a 1981 proposal by the Ronald Reagan White House to abolish NEA. Most recently, former President Donald Trump has repeatedly called for shutting down these agencies. In 2020, his administration provided the NEH with a budget directed towards an eventual shutdown. These plans were reversed by the Biden administration. Having survived multiple challenges, the agencies continue to provide much-needed support for the arts and humanities in America. They continue to be integral to our national cultural landscape. As President Johnson put it, quote, art is a nation's most precious heritage, for it is in our works of art that we reveal ourselves and to others the inner vision which guides us as a nation. And where there is no vision, the people perish, end quote. For Talking Feds, I'm Julian Schlossberg.
Thank you, Julian Schlossberg. You can listen to Julian on his 2 podcasts, Movie Talk and Tales from Hollywood Land, which release weekly on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
All right. It is now time for a spirited debate brought to you by our sponsor, Total Wine and More. Each episode, you'll be hearing an expert talk about the pros and cons of a particular issue in the world of wine, spirit, and beverages.
Thank you, Harry. Today's spirited debate comes with a bit of a twist as we look to the very top of the wine bottle and ask which is better, cork or screw top? At face value, people think screw top equals cheap wine, which, as it turns out, isn't exactly true. The reason for screw tops is to ensure the wine tastes as the winemaker intended. Cork, which has been used to seal wine bottles for over 100 years, is a proven way to age wine effectively by allowing minute amounts of air to come in contact with the wine. This slowly develops a softer texture and enhances flavor. Now cork, traditional as it is, has a downside called TCA, which causes something called cork taint. Now cork taint, while affecting a very small percentage of wines, can be a big disappointment, causing a musty aroma similar to the smell of wet cardboard and contaminating a great bottle of wine. We turn back again to screw caps, which are cork taint proof, of course, not to mention much easier to open, especially in a kitchen surrounded by witnesses. How the aging process affects wines with a screw cap is yet to be known as wineries continue to test. Whether it's a cork or screw top, at Total Wine & More, our guides will help you find the perfect wine to match your tastes. After all, it's not just about what's on top of the bottle, it's what's inside that counts.
Thanks to our friends at Total Wine & More for today's A Spirited Debate.
Okay, look, I do want to have a little bit of time for Mitch McConnell. I'll add my 2 cents here, which is in accord with much of what people said, but I really agree with Jen at the end of the day, because as you say, Norm, if these things happened, it's a problem. But you had a defendant bringing a motion, and the whole thing, he put the cart before the horse and had all this evidence without any kind of proffer that established any basis for it, and it would have been not just safe, but I think absolutely, you know, routine and impeccable to say, Mr. Roman, let's see some affidavits or some proof of a possible problem, and then we can go forward rather than having this whole circus. And I had to date, and maybe in the future, also been impressed with them. All right, let's move on to a different and maybe a larger stage, one that Norm Ornstein knows better than almost anyone in the country. I'd have to say, the announcement yesterday from Mitch McConnell that he's going to be leaving. Our time is short, so I just want to give everybody a chance to respond to, say, these two questions or parts of them. And that is, why is he leaving? And also, does it represent anything in particular by way of a tired resignation that Trump's in charge and he ain't going to be anymore and he's been beat by the man he could have convicted just a few years ago? So, Norm, you get to choose. You want to be first or last, because you're all over this.
I'll go first so that maybe others may even want to respond. I was talking with a Democratic senator who was on the floor when McConnell gave his speech, saying he's stepping down from the leadership, but not from the Senate. And he shook his hand afterward and said to me, he is really, really frail. And we know that McConnell has had serious health problems. He had polio as a child. He fell and had a concussion. We saw these just cringeworthy, horrible moments when he simply couldn't speak. I think health is a part of it. The energy required to be a leader is greater than that of just being a senator. But let's face it, there's another element here. Mitch McConnell, among other things, is singularly responsible for Josh Hawley getting elected to the Senate. Josh Hawley said, the sooner he leaves, the better. For Mitch McConnell, who created this Senate, who recruited a lot of the members, who coddled them, this is a group of people who've turned on him because he is not MAGA enough. And it's ironic because nobody is more responsible for this Supreme Court, for a lot of the horrors that we're seeing out there, than Mitch McConnell. He has carried water for Donald Trump, but like so many others, Trump's undercut him, turned against him, and that's true of other senators. But I can't leave without noting that if we are looking at who's responsible for the denigration of norms, for the poisoning of our political system, Newt Gingrich is number one in my book, but Mitch McConnell follows closely behind. He destroyed the comity in the Senate, destroyed the norms, and they're going to be very, very difficult to bring back. And his legacy is going to be that more than anything else. And it's a shameful one. And it's too bad because I met him when he was new to the Senate. He was a good traditional institutionalist. He's still, at least fortunately, tried to do the right thing with Ukraine and Russia. But he's turned in a direction that has taken him completely to the dark side.
And oy vey, Ukraine and Russia, but all the king's horses and all the king's men. Okay, Norm the Younger.
I'll go next. While I don't have Norm's longstanding relationship, I do know him. He was kind to me in my quest for an ambassadorship because it was, as Norm Ornstein will recall, those Obama years. He called it. That was the beginning of the asymmetrical dysfunction. And Norm and Tom Mann were the first to see it, that a monster had been let out of the box. And it was an asymmetrical one. And I got caught up in that. I was told by one senator, they really fought over my nomination. I was told by one senator, it's not personal. We just want to get back to Obama because he cares, because he's your friend. And he was very upset by it. I won't go into the conversations, but he was very upset by the treatment because it had nothing to do with me. So I got to know McConnell a little bit then. And, Joe Lieberman was a great, and McCain, they were my two, and Kerry, those were my three champions, all figures of a Senate gone by. And McConnell stood before the desk, the clerk's desk, when the vote was happening, and he parceled out the, I later joked about it with him when I was on the floor every day with him for the impeachment. He stood there, and you could see on C-SPAN, thumbs up, thumbs down. He was making sure I had enough votes so I wouldn't be embarrassed or compromised. I ended up with more than half. I think he tallied it out, more than half of the Republican caucus, well over 70 votes, but also not that there were so few that my opponents would not be embarrassed by the scant support for their position in the caucus. So that was my first taste of McConnell's, that is a kind of old Senate compromise where you do the right thing, you get everything done. Then I had the privilege of talking to him, and I made a point of talking to him every day. I won't disclose what was said, because I think the expectation was that it would not be disclosed, and he trusted me. And I didn't write about it in my impeachment book, but I talked to him every day when I was on the floor, because he is, for all of the moral compromises, when you're doing an impeachment trial, you get to sit there on the floor of the Senate. It's the only time in my life that will happen, since my wife has forbidden me from ever running for political office. She hates my TV career enough without having to do it for free. So I talked to him every day and I learned from him, and he was very candid with me about what was going on. So I know Norm is right. He's a destroyer. But, I can't help but, in a sense, at a human level, appreciate that he is a complicated and very interesting, and I think on a human, pure human level, very decent. But on a policy level, he wrecked the Senate and he wrecked our country. And how can you forgive him? But I do forgive him because I know him as a human. It's the oldest, it's like the Washington dinner table privilege. It's an old Washington when I got here, we used to forgive each other our policy sins. You can no longer do that when you're dealing with a creeping autocracy. You don't forgive fascists for having nice table manners. I'm not saying he's one. He's not.
You're not saying he has bad table manners. We know.
And he has lovely table manners. He is not a fascist. He's something else. He's a man who made very poor judgments. He danced with the devil, and the devil burned him in the end.
I wrote a column recently that says, in every fascist threat, there are three types of people. There are the people who are active collaborators. They join the Nazi party. They rat out the Jews in their midst. There are the people who are the resistors. They join the resistance. They hide the Jews. They do the right thing. But the vast majority of people are accommodators. They are moral cowards who refuse to stand up to evil. And they believe by doing so, they will absolve themselves of blame. But in fact, by not confronting evil, by making it have a patina of respectability, they are as bad in their own way as the collaborators. And that is what Mitch McConnell is. When he came to Washington and he declared he wanted Obama to fail because he wanted him to be a first-term president, he institutionalized the notions that Democrats could never legitimately hold power and that the country and the country's interest would come second over his own political, personal ambitions. And he legitimized with his packing of the Supreme Court the notion that there were no restraints, there were no norms, there was no hypocrisy too great, there was no bending and twisting of the rules too great, there was no disingenuousness too horrible to stomach. He made all of that possible. And he, in his own way, was an accommodator of evil. Trump is not Hitler, but he's a fascist. And Mitch McConnell accommodated him.
Can I just say, these are three dazzlingly off-the-cuff comments and really justify where I started with what good friends you are of the podcast. I don't have anything nearly as personal or in-depth, but I will return to my standing objection, Merrick Garland. And for this, I cannot forgive him. All right. And speaking of Mitch McConnell, we got just a minute left for our final talking five. And the question is, what is the aforementioned Senator McConnell looking forward to as he gives up the reins of leadership? Five words or fewer, please, family members.
Shorter days.
There you go.
So first, the preface is he talked to Tommy Tuberville, and the answer is spend more time breeding his family.
I will say, trying to figure out morality.
Okay.
He was never one to act as if morals or morality had anything to do with it.
All right. And I got three words this time. Senior pickleball tour. We are out of time. Thank you so much, Jen, Norm Eisen, and Norm Ornstein. And thank you very much, listeners, for tuning in to Talking Feds. If you like what you've heard, please tell a friend to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever they get their podcasts. And please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube, where we post full episodes, talking books, and bonus video content. You can follow us on Twitter at Talking Feds Pod, and you can look to see our latest offerings on Patreon. Talking Feds is a completely independent production, so if you like the work we do and are inclined to support the show, joining our Patreon is the best way to do it. And you can now leave voicemails with your questions for me and our guests, whether it's for Talking Five or general questions about the inner workings of the legal system for our sidebar segments. All you have to do is call 727-279-5339 and leave a voice message. That's 727-279-5339. And you can still also, of course, email us your questions at questions@talkingfeds.com. Thanks for tuning in, and don't worry. As long as you need answers, the feds will keep talking. Talking Feds is produced by Catherine Devine. Associate producer Meredith McCabe. Sound engineering by Matt McArdle. Our research producer is Zeke Reed. Rosie Don Griffin and David Lieberman are our contributing writers. Production assistance by Akshaj Turbailu, and our music by the amazing Philip Glass. Thanks very much to Julian Schlossberg for explaining the National Foundation on the Arts and the Humanities Act of 1965. Talking Feds is a production of DeLito LLC. I'm Harry Littman. Talk to you later.